If you're enjoying this independent podcast, I'd really appreciate it if you could take a few moments to do a review, like, share and subscribe. And if you'd like to see extra content and show your support, head to the Patreon. The link is in the show notes. Skopje is the capital and largest city of North Macedonia, formerly part of Yugoslavia. The river Vardar runs through its centre, and there are many bridges. I liked it. You knew this was a city that had gone through hard times, but was on the up. Twinkly lights outside restaurants, couples enjoying late-night strolls along the river. I was struck by the number of statues, especially along the riverside, and later learned they were part of a redevelopment project over the past decade, designed to attract people to the city. The locals, less happy with the amount of money spent on them, joke that there are more statues than people. The location of the interview was in a top-floor duplex with an open-plan main floor. Exposed brickwork and plaster gave it an industrial chic feel. There was a motorbike against a wall and a charcoal sketch of a naked woman above where Sam would be sat. The upper loft space had a bed and small bathroom. The only way to get up there was an attractive but terrifying architectural wooden spiral staircase, which was essentially a wooden column with exposed wooden steps winding round and only a rope around the column for you to hang on to.
So basically, if you're scared of heights, you pee out the window. Holy shit! Oh my god!
I recorded this next bit quietly in the toilet because Sam was taking a cameraman with him to record the interview for his archive. The local crew we'd hired might know him. It turns out they did. Now, this is not something we'd usually agree to, but I couldn't raise his suspicions.
I'm so nervous. I can't say anything. This apartment is not what we thought. There's a treacherous staircase to come upstairs to go in the bathroom. Sam is terrified of heights.
I anticipated the staircase leading to the only toilet might be a problem, so I knew I'd have to warn him before we got into the apartment. His wife, Lydia, was also attending, and I'd been told by Mark and Scott she may interfere as she had done during their filming. I've not said much about her so far, but you'll hear a lot more later, and the insights of his victims who believe she's at worst culpable and at best complicit in his crimes. We'll pick up where I left off in the previous episode. I'm outside with cameraman Kirk, and I spot him coming from a completely different direction from what we anticipated. If I was going to get the walking shot, I'd need to run.
You stay there, I'll run into you.
Stating the obvious, but I had to treat Sam like I would anyone I'd interview. Friendly, polite. And I had to ignore the information in my brain about the horrific violations he'd committed against many women.
Hello! We finally meet!
I knew he wasn't a tactile person, but he'd just posted a video interview with a British TV presenter about the importance of hugging. So I decided I'd go in for a hug and test him, and he was surprisingly receptive. He was definitely happy to see me, and I was genuinely pleased to see him, because now I knew we had him, and he couldn't avoid the confrontation.
How are you, Isla? Can I hug you?
Nice to meet you.
Lydia, so lovely to meet you, Lydia. How are you? Hi. Come on this way. I'm sorry it's cold. Are you okay? Well, it's warm inside, and I'm so glad that you suggested.
I didn't suggest.
I'm glad that you forced me to do it inside. Right, we're going in here. Sorry, it's up on the top floor, so there's quite a lot of stairs in this apartment, but I hadn't realised that there's a spiral staircase where you've got to go in the toilet. It's beautiful, but I'm not keen on heights.
Well, I mean, such as it is.
Here we go.
Oh, great space.
Hello. This is Professor Vaknin.
I'm Sam.
Nice to meet you.
Sam.
I'm Kirk, so I'm
sorry.
Nice Kirk, heard the lot
of
Kirk.
Kirk's amazing.
I'm
Victor. And here's your cappuccino.
No.
So
decaf, normal.
Decaf.
I'm not normal, definitely. Normal, completely normal.
He's the decaf. So this is the decaf. Oh, okay, that's you.
There were five crew in the room, including Kirk. Victor, the fixer, was outside. And somewhere on the street, there were two plainclothes police officers who at this point could do nothing if things turned nasty. Sam was much shorter than I expected, and he's tubby. He seems jolly and friendly, but I knew, like Bilbo Baggins in Lord of the Rings, in a flash he can turn into the monster protecting his precious. In this case, the precious is his ego. Anything that challenged it and his sense of reality could provoke him to change.
A little bit of a funny seat, we're going to have you there and here.
Oh, I thought I would be occupying the armchair.
We'd already painstakingly arranged an attractive green velvet sofa for us to sit on. The lighting was all arranged, everything was ready. And although we'd have to sit in a way to have eye contact, I hadn't anticipated this.
We could ride the armchair up to here. Would that be okay?
And
position it like that so that we're both on camera. I would feel very uncomfortable with this arrangement.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
it's a kind of love seat.
I don't think you'll be able to.
Yeah, can you get rid of all this?
Where to get rid of this? Okay. So he wants the seat.
What you're hearing is Sam dragging an armchair into a position in which wouldn't work for any of the cameras. I could see Kirk's face and confusion. I knew we had to agree and adapt. This is precisely what Mark and Scott had warned me about. This wasn't just about comfort. This was about power and control.
We can do something like this. And then I believe you can catch both of us. Could you tell me if you can catch one of us?
That one is the
or
best.
Far.
Kirk.
Or
I can get closer, of course.
We need you that like your position has to be there. If not, I can go in the wooden chair if he's in that chair.
So we had to remove the couch, rearrange all the furniture, and I pulled over a wooden chair, which meant our heights were completely off and I would be looking down on him. But I knew he'd like my reference about the armchair being his throne.
Do you not want to go in the armchair? The armchair is okay.
I don't mind at all sitting on two wooden chairs.
No, I'd rather you look
can
more...
Can you survive it?
We want you more... This is like a throne. We need you enough.
You're appealing to my vanity.
No. This looks nicer.
Kirk and I have worked together before, so we have a good shorthand. So he knew from my face that we just have to agree.
Are we ready to go?
Oh, rolling.
Oh, right, sorry.
I had a list of questions carefully planned out with Mark and Scott. As is my style, I never look at them, but I have my notebook nearby as a safety blanket. I'd memorised the path to lead him to my goal. I knew he would dig a grave for himself the entire way. I know you're dying to hear this, and I'll warn you it's long, but you will learn so much from him because he is an expert on himself and the subject. I may interject to signpost specific things, but here, real time, is my interview with Sam Vaknin.
Where do we begin? Okay, Professor Vaknin, it's a pleasure to be sat here with you finally. And my first question, which is a huge one, which is, what is a narcissist?
You sure know how to get to the point. So thank you for having me. Call me Sam. We'll make the interview a lot shorter. Narcissism, or pathological narcissism to be precise, because there is healthy narcissism. Healthy narcissism underlies phenomena such as self-esteem or self-confidence, or the ability to regulate one's sense of self-worth. So unhealthy narcissism, pathological narcissism, also known as secondary narcissism, is a very multifaceted phenomenon because it's not only a clinical entity, it's not only a diagnosis with diagnostic criteria, with clinical features, with case studies, it's not only that. It's also an organizing principle. What we call a hermeneutic principle, a principle that makes sense of the world, makes sense of society, of individual behaviors, of certain professions. So when you superimpose pathological narcissism on the world around you, suddenly you decode it It's a way to decode it. It's a way to decipher it. It's a way to suddenly imbue it with meaning, direction, purpose. And so many people now use pathological narcissism as a tool to, for example, explain certain political movements and certain political leaders, phenomena such as Me Too, or sexual assault in various industries, etc., etc. This is one dimension of pathological narcissism, which I will not deal with right now, and I will focus on the clinical entity. Mm-hmm. Now, there's a big difference between narcissistic personality disorder and what we call narcissistic style, or more precisely, subclinical narcissism, narcissism that cannot be diagnosed.
So would subclinical be more someone that you might just think selfish or rude or whatever?
Selfish, rude, lacks empathy to some extent, prone to temper tantrums and rage attacks from time to time, and so on and so forth. But all these elements do not coalesce into a disorder of the personality. Someone who is obnoxious, basically. And there are other words which I cannot use on camera. But an obnoxious person would be someone with, very likely, with a narcissistic personality style. But there is no connection whatsoever between a narcissistic personality style and a narcissistic personality disorder. Because the disorder involves massive disruptions to internal psychological processes, to the perception of the world, to perception of others, to interpersonal relationships. It's an all-pervasive, ubiquitous form of psychological malignancy. It's stage four cancer of the mind. And of course, narcissists, people with narcissistic personality disorder, of course they are obnoxious. But this is a superficial similarity. There's no extrapolation here. It's not like if you have a style and then you amplify your style, you suddenly become a narcissist. That's a common misperception, especially online. Now, to answer your question, pathological narcissism, if we focus on the clinical aspects and not on the behavioral aspects, because you could describe pathological narcissism using behaviors. So you could say the narcissist is envious, the narcissist is exploitative, the narcissist lacks empathy. These are all true. Narcissist is entitled, believes that he's entitled to special treatment. Narcissist cuts corners and is essentially intellectually and otherwise lazy. And so these are all true. These are all clinical features. Narcissists are self-enhancing. They seek input and feedback from the environment, the human environment, in order to somehow augment and buttress their inflated fantastic self-perception and self-concept. All these are true. But all these do not touch the core of narcissism. They are phenomenological descriptions of their symptoms. They are not the disease. The disease is much more complex, because pathological narcissism is a disruption to the process of the formation of the self in early and mid-childhood. The self, the constellation, the integration of the self, the emergence of the self has been disrupted. And consequently, ironically, these people are selfless. They lack what Freud used to call ego. They don't have this. They don't have a core identity. Where a person should have been, there is an emptiness, a void, or what some psychologists call a black hole. And so it's an absence masquerading as a presence. It's a kind of simulation of a human being in many ways. And so this is aspect number one. The second pertinent dimension is the fact that narcissists are incapable of perceiving other people as external objects. What they do when they come across other people whom they deem to be useful in some way, they internalize them. They convert them into an internal representation, into an avatar. So they have this library of internal objects, kind of snapshots, and I indeed call it snapshotting. They have a library of snapshots, all of them photoshopped in a process known as idealization. So the snapshots don't even represent accurately and faithfully the external object. And they continue to interact with the internal snapshots or internal objects or introjects. They continue to interact with these exclusively. They cut off the external object. When there is a discrepancy between the external object and the internal object, this gives rise to aggression, devaluation, and ultimately a breakup. Mm-hmm. termination of the relationship because the frustration and the triggering are too much for the narcissist. I've mentioned now discrepancy between external object and internal object. The internal object, of course, is fixated, is permanent, and while the external object has a life of her own. She's independent, she's agentic, she has personal autonomy, she has her own friends, her own family, she makes decisions, she travels, she comes back. And all this grates upon the narcissist because all these proofs or evidence of independence undermine and challenge the permanence of the internal object, the introject constancy. So that drives the narcissist to try to control the external object in order to deanimate her, in order to render the external object an Egyptian mummy, so that in her immobility she would conform perfectly to the static internal object or internal representation. This discrepancy is just one case of discrepancies in pathological narcissism. Another example of a discrepancy is between implicit self-esteem and explicit self-esteem. The narcissist puts on an act. The narcissist is grandiose. The narcissist is self-confident. The narcissist is omnipotent, all-powerful. The narcissist is omniscient, all-knowing. The narcissist is godlike and is a perfect being in every other way. That's the facade. That's a kind of invulnerability signaling or kind of superiority signaling. But the signaling is compensatory. It compensates for something. And what it compensates for is what we call implicit self-esteem. And Adler called, about a century ago, inferiority complex. Deep inside, the narcissist has something known as internalized bad object. It's a coalition of voices, coalition of introjects. For example, mother, father, teachers maybe, influential peers. These voices keep informing the narcissist, you're unworthy, you're unlovable, you're a failure, you're stupid, you're ugly. And to counter these intolerable, burdensome, denigrating, vitiating, negating voices, the narcissist puts on an act of being the exact opposite of the messages of these voices.
It's, sorry to interrupt you there, I've always thought, or you know, narcissists are described as kind of the wolf in sheep's clothing, but what you're describing is a sheep in wolf's clothing.
Yes, we used to, in the history of the study of narcissism, which by the way is one of the first topics to have been studied in psychology. The study of narcissism dates back to Havelock Ellis in 1897. It's a long time. And so what we used to think until more or less the 1990s, or the end of the 1980s, we used to think that all narcissists are happy-go-lucky. They're ego-consonant or ego-syntonic. In other words, what you see is what you get. They really do believe their own inflated, fantastic, grandiose, divine, godlike emanation or signaling. We believed that there was no discrepancy between implicit and explicit self-esteem. And then at the end of the 1980s, we discovered a variant of narcissism. It's a variant, it's like a virus. We discovered a variant of narcissism known as covert or vulnerable or fragile or shy narcissist. Or at the time it was called closet narcissist. And this narcissist clearly possesses the discrepancy that I've described between an inferiority complex, a bad internalized object, and a show, a facade, a theater production. It's a thespian who is kind of... And then we ask the question, is this variant of narcissism the dominant gene, so to speak, or is it a recessive gene? Is it a kind of mutation in narcissism, or is it actually the core of narcissism? Is there? And now we are beginning to think that the only real narcissists are actually compensatory. We're beginning to think that maybe covert narcissism is the only form of narcissism. While overt and grandiose narcissists may be, still being debated, may be a presentation of a psychopathic state. In other words, there's some confluence between antisocial personality disorder, aka psychopathy in the extreme cases, and overt grandiose narcissist. One of the reasons we are having this debate is that there is a tiny group of narcissists, well, 3% of narcissists, who are manifestly and expressly psychopathic. They are known as malignant narcissists. Malignant narcissist is a confluence of narcissism, psychopathy, and sadism. It was first described by Otto Kernberg. And so we now know that there is a subgroup of narcissists who are the bridge between classic narcissists and classic psychopaths. And we're beginning to ask ourselves, are the rest of the group of overt narcissists, are they just attenuated psychopaths? And the only real group is the covert narcissist. So this is the debate now, nowadays.
That's fascinating. And I know the answer to quite a few of these things, but I want to ask you though, and I know that there's not yet the science to back this up, but I was gonna say, you know, are you born one or do you become, which you've kind of answered there, that it's, you become it when you're quite young though.
I would like to qualify this answer with your permission.
Interrupting briefly, you'll notice his answers are very long, and I had to let him do this. If I do interrupt him to clarify a point, I'm careful to apologise. It was important I let him feel he had complete freedom to pass on his wisdom. There were two purposes of this. I genuinely wanted to get his answers on the subject, but I also needed to build up in a natural way so he was comfortable. But as we get closer and closer to my goal, and as listeners, you'll know what I'm eventually leading to, I was becoming more and more nervous and uncomfortable. We'll return to his answer about narcissists becoming one or being born one.
There are strong indications that narcissism is genetically determined. In other words, there must be a hereditary component in pathological narcissism. The reason is that, for example, children who are subjected to the same dysfunctional family environment, the same adverse childhood experiences, some of them become narcissists, others don't. Even among twins. So we have twin studies.
Oh, wow.
One twin becomes a narcissist, the other doesn't. And non-identical twins. So this is a very powerful indicator of but unfortunately we were not able to isolate a gene or an array of genes. And we were not able to trace some kind of gene expression or gene pathway, not even epigenetically across generations, intergenerational transmission. There are no rigorous conclusive studies there are no rigorous conclusive studies that say, that's it, we found the hereditary component and so on. Compare this situation to psychopathy or to borderline personality disorder, where we have a mountain range of studies that demonstrate beyond any doubt that there is a powerful hereditary component in borderline personality disorder and in psychopathy. Compare it to the studies of the brains of people with borderline and psychopathy, where brain abnormalities, structural and functional, are dominant. The psychopath's brain is so abnormal that one could make a species-like distinction. You could say it's a different species.
You can see from the brain scan, I saw
that.
Yeah,
the brains of psychopaths are massively abnormal, like the amygdala, the white matter, every parameter, every organ, everything is distorted. Everything is too big, too small, too inactive, too something. We don't have this in narcissism. We were unable to come up with any conclusive, rigorous evidence that the brains of narcissists are different or that there is a hereditary component. And I think one of the reasons for this is a debate that I've just mentioned. We have failed abysmally, may I add. We have failed to define narcissism in a cohesive, coherent, monovalent manner. There is no definition of narcissism that is agreed upon by all clinicians and all professors of psychology and all scholars. The debate still goes on. And then if you fail to define the clinical entity, how would you be able to correlate it with brain abnormalities or genes? So it's a major issue in this sense. However, we do have conclusive proof, rigorous proof, multi-decade proof that pathological narcissism is powerfully correlated, highly correlated with adverse circumstances in childhood. abuse, trauma, but also smothering, pampering, overprotective parental conduct or misconduct, instrumentalizing the child, for example, to actualize or to realize the parents' unfulfilled dreams and fantasies and wishes, parentifying the child when the parent regresses into infancy and the child has to become the parent's parent. This is called parentifying. All these are forms of abuse because they breach the child's boundaries and they don't allow the child to evolve and become an individual, divided from the parent. The act of separation is disrupted. And so this is a strong indicator that adverse childhood experiences, as we call them, ACEs, are at the core. They are what is known as the etiology. They are the causation of pathological narcissism. But to summarize this very long answer to a very short question, it's very likely that specific environments trigger the expression of specific genes and gene arrays and have an incremental but cumulative impact on the brains of people who become later narcissists, people who are diagnosed with narcissistic personality disorder. Apropos this, one more vignette. Professor Milman from Harvard suggested the idea of acquired situational narcissism. He discovered that people who were never narcissists, when they were exposed to specific environments, became narcissists or indistinguishable from narcissists. For example, rock stars. He studied rock stars. He discovered that when someone becomes a rock star, suddenly, after 4 years, 5 years, they become clinical narcissists. They could be diagnosed safely as narcissists, even though they have not been narcissists prior to the exposure. So there seems to be an environmental triggering of something, of some template, of some potential. That's my long answer to your short question.
It's perfect, and it makes sense. I did watch your interview about Liam Payne, which is precisely that. Are narcissists conscious that they are?
Yes. It's a common myth, and there are dozens of common myths online. The online environment is not only toxic, but it's very misleading. The overwhelming vast majority of information online is misinformation, unfortunately. It doesn't tally with any studies or recent knowledge and so on. One of the myths is that narcissists are not self-aware. It's partly true. Narcissists are fully aware of their actions. They are also partly aware of the impacts that their actions have on other people. Partly aware. They are usually not aware of their motivations and psychological processes. And what narcissists do, they reframe their behaviors. They create a narrative within which their behaviors are commendable or even altruistic. So they assume the moral high ground. It's very interesting that an antisocial narcissist, when asked to explain and justify his or her behaviors, would become a pro-social narcissist temporarily. He would say, I abused her because she needs to wake up to reality. This is tough love, you know? That's why I abuse her. That's why I criticize her. That's why I denigrate her, because that's the only way to wake her up. And she must face reality. Otherwise, she would be taken advantage of and protecting her. You know? So that's a real-life example of reaction. This transition from amorality, because narcissists are not immoral. Immorality is the reserve of psychopaths. Narcissists are amoral. They're just there. Just operate the way viruses do, or tigers do, or hurricanes do. You know, they're a force of nature, if you wish. But the transition from amorality to ostentatious, in-your-face morality, and the casting of the situation in terms of a morality play, good versus evil, with good self-imputed. I'm good, says the narcissist. I'm good. The world is evil. So I have to act in an evil way in order to protect, for example, my loved ones or to survive. There is this constant attempt at self-justification, and it is a key feature. The second thing Because with me, there's never one thing. It's always two, three, seven. So the second thing has to do with the fact that narcissists are cathected. Cathexis is a term borrowed from psychoanalytic literature. And it means emotional or psychic investment in something. Could be another person, could be an object, could be an idea, could be a belief, could be a political party, a nation. Whenever you get emotionally attached to something or derive your sense of value and self-esteem from something, you are cathecting. And the action is called cathexis. Okay? So narcissists cathect their disorder. They're emotionally invested in their disorder. They use something called reframing, which I mentioned before. They generate on the fly narratives that are obviously self-aggrandizing and cast their disorder as an advantage. So it's very typical of a narcissist to say, well, narcissism is the next stage in evolution. Narcissists are much better equipped to deal with the world. They're natural born leaders. And you have even academics, I won't name names, who are glamorizing narcissism and psychopathy. They say, yeah, it's true. Narcissists and psychopaths are uniquely positioned. Evolution has endowed them with the capacity to lead, to make difficult decisions, and so on and so forth. So narcissists and psychopaths would be good military commanders, they would be good surgeons, and so on. The unfortunate thing is that this is true. There is an overrepresentation of narcissists and psychopaths among specific professions, where empathy is a disadvantage. For example, psychopaths are overrepresented among surgeons, medical doctors who are surgeons. Psychopaths are also overrepresented among chief executive officers of Forbes 500 companies. These are the studies by Hare and Babiak. So it seems to be true. Psychopathy and narcissism can be construed as positive adaptations to an environment that had become narcissistic and psychopathic. In short, if you live in a psychopathic world, you would like your president to be a psychopath, to put it this way.
Wow, timely for Trump, just being.
Yeah, you said it. But if you talk to Trump supporters, they tell you, we like it that he is a psychopathic narcissist. We acknowledge it, but we think that's the right qualification for the job. Because the world is full of terrorists and crazy leaders and mayhem and strife and tumult. And to cope in such a world, which is falling apart, which is off kilter, in such a world, you don't need a nice guy. You don't need someone altruistic and benevolent. You need a psychopath. You need a strong leader who couldn't care less about people and would threaten the other party and would get his way. So they glamorize and they narcissism and psychopathy, and they think it's what we call a positive adaptation, not a maladaptation. Imagine the following. Donald Trump comes to me and I work with him and I say, Mr. Trump, I have bad news for you. You are a malignant narcissist. And I think you would benefit from treatment to some extent. Like some of your behaviors can be modified. Donald Trump would say to me, why would I do that? I've been elected twice to the presidency. I had the most beautiful women on earth. I am super rich. I'm super famous. I mean, give me one reason to get rid of my... And I'm all that because I'm a malignant narcissist. This is the secret sauce.
The superpower.
This is my superpower, yeah. I'm that because I'm a malignant. Not despite the fact that I'm a malignant narcissist, but because I am. So malignant narcissism is fast becoming a trait or a constellation of threats to aspire to. In July 2016, if my memory doesn't fail me, New Scientist came with a cover story. Parents, teach your children to be narcissists. Yep, you can find it online.
Wow. To go back to something you said earlier, and this is about, when they're young, there's the emptiness there, and then they need to internalize their, the people to fill themselves up in a way. And I like the description that you literally, it's quite a good visual as well of like turning someone into a mummy. You don't want them to have autonomy. But what the narcissist does throughout their life, if you think of it in a way of being a predator perhaps, of having victims and wanting to, as you've said in many of your videos, like destroy a person really, that's kind of what happened to them when they were young, whether it was parental abuse, neglect, orphaned, you know, bad teacher. It's them being the victim, you know, that the old hurt people hurt people. Would that be right?
Yes, that would be right. And Freud would have complimented you on your version of his repetition compulsion. Freud said that when we have had traumatic or problematic experiences in childhood, we tend to replicate these experiences or reenact these experiences later in life with other people. And this is a compulsion. It's not something we can get rid of. It's with us for life. And so the narcissist similarly recreates or reenacts his childhood environment in his future relationships. Anything that the narcissist has gone through is easily recognizable and identifiable in his interpersonal relationships. For example, the narcissist has never had the chance to separate from his mother and to become an individual. He therefore does not allow his partner to separate from him, nor does he separate from his partner. Narcissists don't do separation because they've never had the experience of separation. And so they merge, they fuse, they revert to what is used to be known as the symbiotic state. They go back to the womb together with the partner and they enact a play of dual mothership. I will be your mother, you will be my mother. And so let's mother each other. But in order to mother each other, we need to be infants again. So let's regress together. And the narcissist and his partner regress into infancy.
Codependency?
This state, of course, creates dependency. As children are dependent on their mothers. I'm mentioning mothers, and this would create a lot of flack, a lot of criticism. But until the age of three, mothers are critical. Fathers, much less so. Fathers become more relevant. They're never critical, but they become more relevant after age three when the child acquires social skills, other types of skills, and so on. Fathers are in the skilling business. They teach the child social scripts, sexual scripts, how to behave in society, how to aspire, goal orientation, how to. We call this semantic memory. Fathers create semantic memory. But this comes much later. The child by the age of three, in some critical aspects, not in all aspects, but in some critical aspects, by age three, the child is fully formed. And that is the role of the mother, and only of the mother.
Nurturing, safety,
yes, what
comfort.
We call secure base, the sense, secure base means the sense of safety, encouraging the child's grandiosity to explore the world, not punishing the child when the child contradicts the mother's insecurities and expectations, and so on. There's a long list of what makes a good enough mother. But there is a consensus in the literature. Starting with Winnicott and Ainsworth and Bowlby, and there's a consensus that it's the mother. And so that's why I keep saying mother, mother, mother. Okay, coming back to the question. My dementia is kicking in, so what were we talking about?
Well, I have ADHD, so my brain goes all over.
Right, we are perfect. That's what we call the perfect couple.
My original question was, I think, about basically they're the victim becoming,
I remember.
But I went off on a tangent, which is why I butterfly.
That's what editing is for. So he reenacts, the narcissist reenacts everything. When I say he, it's she, 50% of all narcissists are women. So there's a reenactment process. So narcissist has never experienced separation, he doesn't allow for separation. Narcissist has never become an individual, so he regresses to an infantile state. He never becomes an individual in the relationship also. As you've mentioned, it's a dependency relationship, not a healthy one. Narcissists were never allowed to get in touch with reality. the parent isolated, or the mother in this case, isolated the narcissist, did not allow the narcissist as a child to interact with peers, to experience reality in all its harshness and abrasiveness, or the mother was absent and did not provide pushback, because mother represents reality. So there was no mother there, she was depressed, she was selfish, she was whatever. We call it dead mother, metaphorically. She was a dead mother, absent, mm-hmm. and so there was no pushback. One way or another, the child who would later become a narcissist as an adult has never had contact with reality. Consequently, as an adult, this child defaults into fantasy. So the whole baggage of childhood is superimposed on interpersonal relationships in adulthood. Some things the narcissist is constitutionally incapable of because he's never experienced them. And some things are preferences. The narcissist prefers fantasy to reality, even though he's perfectly capable of interacting with reality and acting on reality, he still would have a preference for fantasy. In fantasy, he's omnipotent, it's like a director of a film.
You can't get hurt in fantasy. I'm so sorry to interrupt. Is that a problem? Oh, God. Sorry, someone's drilling. I'm so sorry.
I know how we would do it in Israel.
Like the gun joke he made during the session with Richard Grannan in Prague, that was his solution to the drilling noise here. We broke the filming briefly so a crew member could ask for the drilling to stop from a neighbouring property. And at this point, Sam attempted to climb the spiral staircase to go to the toilet, but his fear of heights prevented him from getting all the way up. So he stepped into the communal hallway and peed into a cup, much to the displeasure of his wife. I'm not sure what he did with the contents of the cup, but I'm assuming it was thrown out of the window. While I was happy for the unusual breather, I was keen to get back on track when he sat down again.
If I may make a recommendation, mm-hmm. Just ask away. Don't assume that I've already answered or something.
Yeah.
I always have something to add, something to... Mm-hmm. So you'll get much richer material if you just plow ahead with your questions. And
sure. Are we ready? Okay.
Presumably you're editing this. So
yeah.
No worries.
Oh yeah, there'll be right, so we just covered the victim. You know, they're really a kind of a victim. You could look at them in that way and have sympathy. Actually, this may be a good way to go in. So what you've already described to me is you might have sympathy for narcissists when you're thinking of them as a vulnerable child who's not had the love and nurturing. But we do need to be aware because narcissists are dangerous, can be dangerous.
I would strongly advise against having sympathy for narcissists under any pretext and so on. I think we should judge other people by the consequences of their actions and their ability to control and modulate their behavior and their willingness to do so. And so in this case, the narcissist, for example, is fully aware of his or her actions and the impacts these actions would have on other people, but he couldn't care less. He couldn't care less, either because it's an antisocial narcissist who is goal-oriented, or because there's a narcissist who experiences compulsion to reenact early childhood conflicts and so on, or because it's a narcissist whose self-aggrandizement trumps everything else. And this kind of narcissist would be ruthless and callous in pursuing narcissistic supply and in buttressing his or her grandiose, fantastic, inflated self-image. Either way, the people at the receiving end of the narcissist are usually heavily traumatized, heavily damaged, and I don't think they should make any concessions, or I even think it's counterproductive to try to understand the narcissist, because this automatically triggers compassion, empathy, and I think it's a luxury victims cannot afford. Because narcissists are seriously dangerous. Now try to explain why I think narcissists are more dangerous than psychopaths. Substantially more dangerous, actually. While the prevailing view, or the common sense view, or the layman's view, is that psychopaths are much more dangerous. Because you have this media image, the psychopaths go around slashing people in slashers, you know, they are serial killers and what have you. The overwhelming vast majority of psychopaths are run-of-the-mill neighbors and friends, and I mean, they're totally otherwise normal people. Where they become psychopathic is when they pursue a goal. And so they're goal-oriented. And then they would become ruthless and callous and couldn't care less and disempathic and even aggressive or, in extreme cases, violent. But these are rarities, actually. One could say that psychopaths are simply a caricature of normal human beings. They're exaggerated versions of you and me, or you. They're exaggerated versions of people. Whereas you would want to have sex, and the psychopath would want to have sex, you would have boundaries. You would adhere to some code. You would observe some civilities and social norms. You wouldn't trespass or transgress against the boundaries of other people, and so on. Psychopath wouldn't do that. Psychopath would pursue the goal of having sex to its extreme, and may end up, for example, sexually assaulting someone. Whereas you would want to have money, and the psychopath would want to have money, the psychopath would use any means to realize this goal, would trample on people, if necessary, would kill people. So a psychopath is an unbridled, disinhibited version of a totally normal, typical human being.
But would they, sorry to interrupt, what you just said there about the, you know, they could go to the point of sexual assault, would they view it as sexual assault, or would they view
yes.
it as, they would know, so they
yes,
do know the difference between
yeah,
right
but
and wrong?
As far as, but they would reframe it. They would say my assault is justified because she has been teasing me or provoking me or misleading me or whatever. That's her due punishment. Or maybe she's been stupid enough to invite me to her hotel room. She deserves it. She had it coming, etc. So there's a lot of justification narratives.
I've covered a lot there. Of rape cases, yeah. and that's precisely what yeah. would, you know...
Well, I hope that I'm giving you correct information.
But that would be how it's framed. They're like,
yes,
well,
yes.
I was invited back there, so that
Absolutely.
Means yes. And,
yes. So the concept of consent with psychopaths is very fluid and highly prejudicial, highly self-centered. Consent from my point of view. There's nobody there. I mean, the consent is me. I'm processing the consent. Okay, well, that's not the main argument. What I'm trying to say is that you can understand psychopath. You can put yourself in the psychopath's place. You also want money. You also want power. You also want to have sex. You also want, you know, it's understandable. It's exaggerated. It's disinhibited. It's immoral. It's socially frowned upon. But it's human. That's not the case with narcissists. Not the case with narcissists. A narcissist converts you into an internal object within a fantasy and then coerces you into the fantasy. And a narcissist uses an infinite array of manipulative Machiavellian techniques, punishments, overt aggression, passive aggression, undermining. It's a totally toxic environment. Every molecule of the air is imbued with toxicity, oozing manipulativeness and so on. So the exposure to a narcissist is annihilating. Whereas the exposure to the psychopath may be traumatic. It's pinpointed. A psychopath would obtain his goal and go away. A narcissist has to keep you embedded in the fantasy. A narcissist would never let you go. You are never free. You are a figment. You're a prop in a theater production. You're an object. A narcissist totally objectifies you and totally dehumanizes you. But while the psychopath objectifies you and dehumanizes you in order to accomplish something, and once it is accomplished, it's gone, as a narcissist dehumanizes you and objectifies you because he wants you to die. Not in the physical sense, but definitely as far as your agency or independent action or ability to abandon him or reject him. So a narcissist invades your mind. By the way, actually invades your mind It's a hostile takeover. It takes over your mind. He then converts it into a kind of resonant module with his mind. And then you become symbiotically attached. It's a kind of chimera or cyborg, if you wish, whatever you want to call it. I'm out of metaphors and or similes. And then you become an extension of the narcissist. It is exquisitely difficult to extricate yourself. And the grief, having extricated yourself, is long-lasting and in itself traumatizing. There's nothing remotely like this with the psychopath. Even if you've been raped or you've been, you know. Yeah, it's a horrible experience. It's traumatizing. You pay the price. You need help. It's all true, all very true. But number one, it's understandable. I mean, these actions are understandable. They're not commendable. They are criminal, but they're understandable. They're within the human experience. What the narcissist imposes on you is surrealistic. It's nightmarish. It's borrowed out of a sci-fi novel. It's another planet. You know, Kazetnik was an author who has written about his experiences in Auschwitz. And then he was summoned, subpoenaed, to testify in the trial of Adolf Eichmann, who was in charge of the logistics of the Holocaust. And Kazetnik went on the stand, and then he said, no one can ever understand Auschwitz. Never mind how long we speak and how deeply we go into details. It's an experience out of human experience. And then he said, it's another planet, and he fainted on the stand. He collapsed on the stand. Very famous scene from the Eichmann trial. It's the same with the narcissist. It's something non-communicable. When you talk to victims and ask them to describe their experiences to you, even therapists, when they ask victims to, the victim is out of words. The victim is incapable of communicating the realities of the situation. She can dwell, or he can dwell, on details or events or occurrences, but the totality of the experience evades the victim. And so many people distrust the victim. They disbelieve the victim. Because the victim has to trivialize the experience in order to be able to communicate it. And it's not a trivial experience. It's an all-pervasive, all-consuming cellular experience. I know that I sound as if I'm engaging in hyperbole or as if I'm exaggerating for effect for the camera. Trust me, I'm not. I think I'm underdoing it.
I know you're not.
And the reason I knew he wasn't exaggerating was I'd listened to the 9 hours of interview with one of the victims. He, ironically, is backing up everything that you will hear in later episodes. So I want you to remember what he said here. It's almost impossible to put into words what has happened to them. I'm going to stop there because there's a lot more to come as we get into the nitty-gritty. When I ask him if narcissists fear getting caught and what happens if they are publicly exposed for the wrongdoing.
And then you come along, you humiliate him in public, everyone is a witness, everyone smirks, he's been ridiculed, he's been mocked, he's been humiliated, he's been exposed, he's been criticized, and all the defenses crumble.
And just as I was about to pull out the pin of the grenade, our interview got interrupted and almost derailed.
Okay, let's finish this.
Sorry.
Are we good to go?
And finally, my mask comes off.
Do you feel bad for what you've done to these women?
I am not going to.
When they come to you and they're broken and they need help?
The storyteller Narcissus Playbook is written, produced and edited by me, Isla Traquair. And it's the 4th in the Storyteller series. This is an independent production and I rely on you, the listeners, to help spread the word by showing your support. It doesn't cost anything, just a few clicks to like, share, subscribe, and review. And soon there'll be extra content available on my Patreon for the price of a cup of coffee, including analysis, evidence, regular videos, and more. Thank you for listening. If you've been affected by narcissistic abuse, there are links for support in the show notes.